Davey D, Hard Knock Radio, hanging out with you this afternoon. Want to continue to focus on the attacks that are taking place in the arena of education. And somebody who's been really pounding the pavement, raising the clarion call, and has written a book about it is Nolan Higdon. He's a critical media literacy scholar, author, and university lecturer specializing in media studies, history, and education. Teaches at the University of California, Santa Cruz, and Cal State University, East Bay, where he focuses on propaganda, misinformation, digital culture, and the political economy of news media. He's the author of a number of books, including The Anatomy of Fake News, co-authored The United States of Distraction, and now has a new book out called MAGA Academy. And welcome to the show, Nolan. This is not your first rodeo in terms of talking about this topic, but I think for many people, they're having what some would describe as an aha moment. They're seeing the things that you've been talking about for years and they're going, I can't believe this is happening. Our universities are being taken over. And let me give the, I think, real life example, and a real life example that resulted in somebody who I know, who's like a little nephew, friend of a good one of my best friend's kids, came up to Cal, was excited to go there, and he came up and visited just as Cal started putting these crazy restrictions on free speech, right? This is the most recent thing. I'll let you kind of lay that out. And he walked around this campus and he was like, this is not a place I want to be. I'm going to go back to Southern Cal. His dreams were shattered. He came away realizing that this historic university that had really sold an image of free speech, adventurism. If you get away from home, you come to the beautiful Cal, UC Berkeley campus, the history of free speech and all the things that have become associated with that university. His words was he felt like it was very right wing and very restrictive and wanted no parts of it and bounced. And this is a top-notch student. And I think it's interesting because for his parents, they were like, wow, what the hell happened to my school? And this is going on and on. The more recent things I think is that in addition to the restrictions, Cal just pulled all the pictures ranging from Dr. King to, Dolores Huerta, all these things that were in a building, the multicultural center that people fought for because they were excluded years ago when I was at school. And now, they're saying, well, we're just going to remove all this, and, under the guise that not all students, in particular Zionist students, didn't feel welcome. The Palestinian flag was an offense, those types of things. And here we are, with people having an aha moment. But you have been talking about this for many, many moons, if I could quote the great E-40. So I don't know how you feel about that. Maybe your audiences are larger now. Maybe people are walking up and apologizing and saying you were right. But welcome to the show, Nolan.
It's funny you bring that up. And first of all, let me say a pleasure being on the show. Always a pleasure to chat with you and someone who keeps it real and keeps independent media alive. But it's funny you should start that conversation with the story of your, I think you said nephew from Cal, because I start the book in late 2024. This is not a Trump book. This is not a lefty bashing Trump type story. In fact, it's kind of appealing to people who are anti-Trump to understand how we get to the Trump moment, what things we could have done differently in the academy. And I started late 2024 for the same reason you told that anecdote. There we were. I was a faculty member talking on behalf of my union, basically begging the university to allow me to use my First Amendment rights and allow my students to use First Amendment rights on campus. The summer previously had after the clampdown on encampments that were critical of U.S. support for Israel and Gaza, They changed all the rules about protests on campus that summer while faculty and students were gone, and essentially made it impossible to protest. And the reason why I think your anecdote fits so well, and I talk about this in the book, is this: so many of these universities, particularly here in California, but all over the country, they love to attract students by saying, like, you're the best, you're the brightest, you lead the way, we're student-centered. We have the legacy of the 1960s where, the 60s college kids stuck it to power. And then these students get there and they see they're being micromanaged by what effectively is a corporate operation. And if they step out of line and participate in protests, they get steamrolled by an administration that's willing to call in the police. And I wrote this book because all the things that folks don't like about what Trump has done to higher ed, and believe me, there are plenty, and I go through them in the book. A lot of it, he simply used mechanisms that 40 years of corporate neoliberalism had allowed. A lot of the stuff was championed by the Democratic Party, which is a party that most people in higher ed seem to support. And so I kind of lay that story out in the book as a way to say, one day Trump will be gone. We can't go back to the way it was in 2015, for example. We need to reconceptualize what we want the university to be.
Nolan, let's start off with the breakdown of this long walk towards the type of authoritarianism that you see on campuses. And you just alluded to it. You talked about neoliberalism. For people who don't know, let's explain that because you do in the book, and then talk about the policy shifts that we started to see in universities, which. I think for many people, they seem pretty benign. In fact, they seem like they made common sense until they started being put in action. But let's start off with the neoliberalism question.
Yeah, so neoliberalism is basically kind of a rebranding of laissez-faire capitalism, in the sense that it's a blind belief in markets. It's a belief that technological progress is the best thing for humans, and the government, even with the best intention, should not be regulating or engaged in taxation because all those things hurt progress and hurt the market. It believes that corporations run things more efficiently than the public sector. And it believes things like unions just get in the way. And it thinks the market should be in all aspects of our lives. And neoliberalism, I mean, with some minor changes, every president, certainly from Jimmy Carter through Joe Biden, exhibited this neoliberal behavior. And one of the targets was education, because neoliberals believe that in this global economy, and this really comes in the 1970s. Now, first of all, I should say we've theoretically always had a global economy. I mean, the globe has always existed. But they talk about this idea of quote unquote free trade, which really means that corporations can go anywhere to get the cheapest labor and dictate policy. But like organized labor, like unions, can't take their livable wage or their healthcare benefits with them to another country. So it's really a way of hurting labor. And so the question was, okay, well, if you take away all those manufacturing jobs in somewhere like the United States, a place where you could graduate high school at 18 and get a job for 30 years and own a home and have a car in the driveway and retirement and money for your kids to go to college, what are they going to do instead? And the neoliberal answer was, well, we're going to be a service sector economy. You're not going to need people to, break their back working in this job or that. We'll all be service sector. But the problem is the service sector is split two ways. You can either be a low-paid worker at something like Starbucks or Target, or you can be a high income earner, maybe in like the medical field or a lawyer or a professor. Those higher earnings require college. And Bill Clinton made this sort of pitch that he used to say this aphorism, you have to learn so you can earn. And it was going to be everyone's going to get a degree. We're all going to be college professors and lawyers and doctors, and poor people around the world are going to be doing all that labor. And then, of course, that begs questions. Well, how are people going to get to college who can't afford it? Well, we'll make student loans available. And so you end up with generations of people in student loan debt.
Oh,
At the
sorry.
same time, there was this specter that the country was looking like it was falling behind in the global race in a lot of ways in the 1970s. And they said, well, education's to blame. Too much of these educators are focused on democracy and liberal arts and feel good stuff. If we're now looking at a global economy, we need to make higher education focused on the global economy. And that means restructuring it. And this meant breaking faculty unions, bringing in more management for being efficient. And one of the ways they do these things is they got rid of tenure track jobs and replaced them with these non-tenure or part-time workers, sometimes called adjuncts, sometimes called lecturers. They have different names at different
Right.
universities, but they make less. They often don't get benefits. They can be fired at will. And they have to work, two, three, four campuses to make a living. So technically, they're double or triple workers, not part-time workers. And that really weakened faculty. It empowered management. At the same time, students now for generations have been told college is about getting a job. So they go there, going hugely in debt. They're basically treated like customers, and the customer's always right. And so it really changed the way education functioned and the relationship between students, faculty, and the administration. And it was that weak and vulnerable system that Trump really seized upon when he came to power in 2025 again.
You know, as you were talking, Nolan, I'm thinking a few things come to mind. One, the hustle that Bill Clinton kind of sold, which is, you got to earn to learn. Let's talk about what he did around the lending policies that led to people. Let's put it this way. When I graduated, I owed 3,700 and something odd dollars for my 5-year stay at Cal, right? That's it. And I'm talking to people that owe 100,000 or more for undergraduate degree. So, and we're not talking about, oh, Dave, you graduated in 1970, or no, we're talking about 90s on up. So let's talk a little bit about what happened, because it was on his watch. We saw the explosion of this loan policy, which to me was the ultimate pimp move.
Yeah, it Clinton in the White House, really Joe Biden in the Senate at that time, they spearheaded this kind of perverse incentive where colleges and universities knew these loans were readily available, and that meant that theoretically, as long as you could get into a college,
Hold on
you
1 second. Hold on 1 second.
yeah.
Alexa, turn off. Something was happening to the machine. It just kept going on. I'm like, what's going on? Go. Sorry about that. Go ahead.
No worries. So Bill Clinton in the White House and Joe Biden in the Senate, which interestingly is part of the story, they really create some perverse incentives through this student loan option. Now you have to remember, Reagan Revolution started at the governor's level here in states like California, but essentially what they did was they were cutting budgets to universities and colleges that were close to free, and free in some cases, but close to free in others. And so schools had to make up funding, and tuition became very convenient thanks to what Bill Clinton and Joe Biden and other Democrats and Republicans did in the late 1990s, which is they made these loans available to people, private loans backed by the federal government. And Biden, who was known as the senator from MasterCard, they made it impossible to get rid of these student loan debts through bankruptcy. So effectively, this was taking out a loan that was going to be around your neck forever, no matter what happened after graduation. And it put colleges and universities in a position where they said, like, well, we need to compete for those students to enroll at our college or university versus another one, because we know they have guaranteed money. We just need them to enroll. So you don't, you know, you, they didn't do that through creating better scholarship or smaller class sizes. Instead, they did it through gymnasiums, pools, parties, soccer fields, all these kinds of amenities to attract their attention. And over time, the university becomes more and more expensive, less focused on scholarship and knowledge. And really, what universities and colleges were selling was a quote unquote experience. And this experience often went in the direction of things that had nothing to do with learning. Me and my students in our media and education class, we always look at advertisements for higher ed. My students are always struck how little classrooms or teachers there are in advertisements for higher education, because that's not what they're selling. But we can talk about this too. The quality of education in some measurements has declined. And as a result, these students are taking on this massive amount of debt for an experience, but not really getting what they're paying for.
is the voice of Nolan Hitgen, and we're talking about his new book, MAGAcademy. And as he pointed out earlier, it's more than just about MAGA, but really looking at the sustained attacks on it, on education. And now, as I said at the beginning, people are having the aha moment because all this stuff is coming into fruition. I want to come back to something that you talked about. The student is customer. And that's kind of a theme throughout the book. Let's talk about that because that in itself, and I'm sorry about the alarm that's going off. It's not my car. You might hear it in the background, but I want to talk a little bit about the student as customer and how that's been a hustle as well on many levels, some of it a little bit more insidious than others. But talk about this shift and what that really means when we say the student is customer.
Yeah, and I want to just preface this by saying this isn't a book that's complaining about the young people or the students. Quite the opposite. I'm complaining about the context in which we put these folks, and the way they view higher ed is largely a result of what previous generations did. So I think that's important to say up front. But look, these students are told basically since the cradle that everything they do needs to be to get into a good college so they can get a good job or they won't have a good life. They then, risk taking on, like you mentioned, I think you said roughly about $3,000 worth of debt. They're taking on upwards of 100,000 or more. I mean, effectively, they're taking on a mortgage at 18 years old, with no
Right.
way to pay for
Yeah.
it.
I had 3,000 debt,
Yeah.
in 5 years.
Yeah.
My colleagues who came afterwards have 100,000 that they're paying off. I know one that has $300,000 in debt, and it's almost impossible to get from under. And we're talking about people with PhDs, and you're saying, well, you should just get a job. Well, I mean, I'm not putting people's business out there, but it's certainly, in many ways, very close to a mortgage, with very little relief, and to the point that people have to move out of state. They have to take on three or four jobs. So they went from, maybe doing part-time work and doing all this, and balancing school to now having two or three jobs to make household expenses, loans be repaid. And then people, in an act of cruelty, it says, well, you should have been more responsible. Well, you told everybody to go to
Call
school
exactly.
so they can get a degree. And now they got the degree, and now they're being told that they were irresponsible.
And that's one of the fascinating things. I interview a lot of those folks in the book who talk specifically about, like, when I ask them, hey, would you recommend your students to get in this profession? And I won't use the swear words, but it's F no, is literally what I heard from multiple people because of their experience. But the students, they take on this massive amount of debt, and then they come in with a different perspective. They want a job, they want a career for all that money. They're looking at the debt over their head, and a lot of teachers are looking for different things, such as teaching content knowledge, teaching critical thinking, teaching about democracy, teaching about community building. And there's this kind of push against one another in a lot of respects. Some students aren't interested in perhaps in those things. Other students perhaps think they can't afford to be interested in that type of content. And it leads to this, what they call, scholars call this disengagement compact, where effectively the students say, well, look, we won't haggle the faculty or give them bad evaluations as long as you pass us through. And the faculty look the other way, kind of pass a lot of students through so they don't lose their job. And especially since a lot of them are non-tenure part-time faculty, they can be easily replaced with someone who doesn't get bad reviews from students. And because the university often defines student success as students passing, all the incentives are there to pass to keep your job. And I'd give some anecdotes about the ways in which students view the classroom. I talk about how a colleague told me that they asked a student who had taken the same class with another instructor the term before and failed, like, hey, what are you going to do different this time? And the student said nothing. I had a bad teacher. It's really this idea that the customer is always right. And it's very difficult environment to actually have students learn. You're up against so many things, not to mention if you're teaching on multiple campuses.
Right, and this is not limit. This can take on a different form in the elite schools. I mean, because There, not only are you paying the money, but you often have students say, well, my dad owns this wing, my mom, you know, and so this idea of the customer. But what it seems to boil down to is that we're no longer about learning. It's about something else. It's about getting this piece of paper, and that's going to equate to the job. The question for you, and do you break this down in the book, are the jobs there? From what I'm gathering, no. But you tell me what you've been finding. Is it worth the price of admission?
Increasingly, no. This has been one of the, I think, rocky transitions we're going into. This year in particular, we're seeing some of the highest rate of unemployment amongst recent college graduates. This gets more into like my media work, but they're blaming a lot of this on AI. I think AI is an excuse to hide a recession. A lot of what's happening is being blamed on AI, but I'm not convinced AI is really the villain here. But to your point about the piece of paper I bring out in the book, and this is some of the things I've gotten a little more controversy about, but I bring up this idea of accommodations in the book, which is something a lot of universities and colleges offer, which is there's students with different learning needs who get accommodations. This could be a student who's differently abled, maybe has speech issues. They get support from the campus. And there are students who do need these services. We've all met them. If you've ever been a teacher, you've known how much of a big difference this has made. But there was an article from a Stanford student who was pointing out that her and her other students talk openly about how they fake issues to get accommodations. And it's an open secret that this is how you can get like a better dorm room. This is how you can get longer time on tests. You don't have to study. And there's this sort of students in different universities who are making this claim. And I even talked to some of my students. I said, well, what do you guys think about this? And first, they kind of pushed back. They said, no, some students really need it. I said, no, I know that. That's not what they're saying. They're saying that there are some students getting it who know they don't need it, but just getting it to pass. And they were pretty open. They said, yeah, you know, this is like an open secret here. And they pointed out, like, look, we don't get many things free in this country, like healthcare. So this is one of the few advantages we get, is kind of how they looked at it, which I thought was a little unique. But it becomes more of a system of, or more of a process of gaming the system to get the degree versus actual learning. And we know like wealthier students tend to get these accommodations more at like the high school level and then transfer them over with them to college, which we see as well. So it's another kind of disadvantage in these universities that promote so much social justice and equity through these processes.
In the book, you talk about the first term of Trump. Can we go through that, what that meant? Because it's there that you start to get the DEI language and all these different, you know, it's an accommodation of sorts, but an accommodation to systemic issues that needed to be covered up. So you break this down pretty eloquently.
During Donald Trump's first term, I think a lot of liberals treated him as kind of an aberration. It was a mistake that if we just get rid of him, we can go back to 2015 again. And in the colleges and universities, this was like an open secret. I cite some studies of faculty who documented the ways in which faculty would just talk about MAGA, say things like, these, you know, MAGA students are in my class, I wish they would drop, or they're unreachable. There was this really kind of like disdain, and the university to kind of virtue signal that it was different than Trumpism, that it was like a real inclusive social justice alternative, really leaned heavy into the DEI rhetoric. And I make a difference in the book between kind of corporate DEI, which I think is putting like a diversity, equity, inclusion face on corporate policies that exploit historically marginalized communities and create the conditions for that exploitation, versus actual diversity, equity, inclusion, which I'm for. For example, like, why is it that the DEI model is if you can make it through the racist system somehow for 18 years, you'll be lucky enough to get into a college where you can go massively in debt to have an opportunity to pull yourself out of those economic conditions, versus something like, say, reparations, earlier. So I break up those kind of differences between kind of corporate DEI and actual DEI throughout the book, and I give more examples of that. But this language worked pretty strong. But I think it also created a serious opportunity to weaponize it in the university that Trump will use later. When Trump takes power, and he picked this up from the Bidens, Trump was justifying a lot of his destruction of higher ed on the fact he was fighting anti-Semitism. Just like previously, a lot of the corporate initiatives in higher education were justified as fighting like racism or sexism, when in fact they were doing neither. I point out in the book that like the massive amount of management that was put in place supposedly for DEI would tout how they had like hired more women and people of color, which is a good thing, but they were ultimately disproportionately hired to those non-tenure part-time positions, some of the most exploited positions, not the tenure track positions. So it's things like that that I point out in the book about how the rhetoric didn't match the reality.
Well, I want to come back to this. We're talking with Nolan Hibden. If I'm sorry, Nolan, I'm mispronouncing your
It's
name.
all good. All good.
The thing that I'm looking at with the universities is it's framed as a left-right thing. But within the university itself, there are some serious turf battles, and in the first term, you're looking at progressives versus, the corporate Dems, the Hillary faction versus the Bernie faction. I'm just looking from my own experience, the large number of people who are coming from other countries and how they may po be politically aligned. And to the point of diversifying the campus, that's something that I always found to be a very tricky and very interesting synopsis in this regard. If you're looking at sheer numbers, you can go, yeah, we hired more folks. But it's almost as if some of those universities, they very strategically to this day will look and understand what you're about. So let's say you are, part of Project Censored, disinformation, propaganda, all these different things is what you're about, and we can put you under the guise of investigative journalism. And you have all your colleagues there, right? Mickey Huff and, everybody's there. But now I'm going to come along and I'm going to send Barry Weiss to be your dean. The head of CBS. She's a journalist, investigative journalist, all these different things. But I knew ideologically that I could put somebody in the midst and cause disarray in your situation. So we saw this in Black Studies. You would have Black Studies, and they put a conservative Black guy there who's like, we're going to get rid of all this stuff, and would use language that seemed to make sense to the outside looking in, but internally, you're going, everything's in disarray because you deliberately put somebody who is ideologically, culturally, and politically very, very different than the faculty. And we see a lot of this on the campus. So how do we kind of make sense of that? Because in many ways, it allowed, the MAGA takeover that you talk about to happen. Because they could just label all of it far left, even though within the departments, it's like it's not far left, is our dean is far right, to what the faculty and the students are. But, I'll let you have it at that.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And I think the way to understand that is, I always say, like, so when you apply to the college or university, or you as a student or an employee, they make you fill out this thing called a diversity statement. But I think it should be better understood as a homogeneity statement. It's kind of a look at your ideology. It's not just like, do you believe in being anti-racist? It's which way do you want to go about that anti-racism? What are you going to be on campus? Are you going to do the corporate approach, or you want to do a much more like radical deconstruction approach, say something like the progressives? And I think the university does a really good job of being obsessed with the diversity what they can see to hide the homogeneity of ideology that you can't see. And you gave that example. I always give this on a sort of on a lecture circuit when they try and discredit a speaker for their identity. I'm like, well, I could bring in like Condoleezza Rice if you want. Would that be a woman of color? And they're like, no, not her. I'm like, well, what's different about her? It's obviously the ideology. They want someone who's progressive. And so that ideological component, I talk about throughout the book, that really what the professional managerial class has done is really gotten rid of a lot of folks. The folks who kind of make it in higher ed today who are more radical or progressive either got in before the PMC, professional managerial class, had consolidated power, or they knew to play the game on the application and they somehow got in either as an adjunct or a tenure track faculty and are holding on to it. But they're few and far between. That's why I always laugh when like right wingers pretend like our faculty lounge is full of like radical Marxist rhetoric. I'm like, are you kidding me? Like it's corporate centrist MSNBC talking points.
Right. Definitely. And but to the degree that it's framed a particular way, I guess the question would be, what is the end game? Because in reality, it's like, well, it is really kind of diverse, ideologically speaking. And the folks that you are attacking actually, in many ways, are aligned to many of the things that, meaning these power structures are for. So what is the end game in attacking it? Because it's, as you said, it's not overrun with the rhetoric that is being sold to the public. What's the end game?
You're talking about coming from the right?
Yes.
Yeah, I think the right has always recognized that higher education does have some power, particularly cultural power, even if it's a culture that progressives may not like. One of the ways in which a lot of this like corporatism has been justified is by instead of giving like material assistance, it'll give like cultural assistance. So promote, more people of color in positions of management or things like that. And the right simply finds that to be an abysmal outcome. They don't want to see, for example, women with a corporate job having like a child out of wedlock and living single. They don't want to see they don't want to see a halftime show with Puerto Rican music or anything like that. Like that, there does seem to be a racist, sexist component even to like kind of the vapid corporate inclusivity that we get from the neoliberals on the part of conservatives.
But is college increasing in terms of people wanting to go, considering the bad name that it's getting, especially coming from the right? I look at a place like Texas and see the kind of crackdowns they're doing in the UT system. Okay, you did all this crackdown. What is the end game? Did you get more people applying now? Did, folks say, oh, now it's a welcome place for me? Or is the end game just to dismantle it completely?
It's tough to say. I think dismantling the radical component is certainly a goal,
But that's
but
already happened for the most
I,
part.
yeah, and I think the goal is these folks are making a lot of money for themselves and their corporate partners. There's a ton of money to be made by transferring higher education into a money-making venture. That's why I say like neoliberals. I don't think they necessarily care that they have more people of color, women working with them or not working with them. That's not a major concern. That's a sales point for making money. These universities are heavily involved in real estates. They're heavily involved in corporate contracts. A lot of these like people at the executive level of higher ed are either tied to or will end up in corporate America. There's so many opportunities to make money by treating the university like this. And the students and faculty and the staff, we should point out, are just your cheap labor. They're the ones that facilitate your kind of ladder climbing.
What happened with the COVID? That's another thing you talk about. And how did that affect the universities?
I think COVID was a disaster for the universities, just in general, whether you're left, right, or center. I think there's a lot of people who wish to hide how they reacted during COVID. I think a lot of the nation find it to be a very embarrassing moment for a multitude of reasons. And higher ed was no different. It moved very quickly online. Everyone was home online, which meant people got a peek behind the curtain, not just at what was going on in the classroom, but a lot of like university events were online as well. And some of this stuff did not play well to audiences. I talk about the speaker who was a black woman who was talking about how she has dreams of killing white people. That was, of course, plastered all over the internet and not a good look for higher ed. I talk about how Joe Rogan really championed a lot of his episodes and shows about lampooning higher ed, about these ideas of safe spaces, these ideas of day of campus with no white people. The folks who did these fake studies that they sent into journals that were fake studies basically full of kind of virtue signaling. One was like on dog rape, things like that. And
Right.
you had people like Matt Taibbi, who were previously kind of associated with the left, writing articles about higher ed negatively. He wrote this really bad article about Marcuse and the Academy and all this. But regardless of what you feel about the content that was coming out online, it sparked a lot of negative discourse about higher ed. I think part of it is a kind of a lot of the, vapid corporate nonsense we had on campus. Another part of it was just a lot of this stuff is taken out of context. Like knowledge production is messy. We think out loud, we try ideas. And just because you try an idea out loud doesn't mean it's going to be forever, but online it was. And coming with that, you also had people just lose kind of faith in the university education. And you also saw a lot of companies coming out of COVID change their hiring policies to get rid of the bachelor's degree for entry level. And so people started begging the question, like, do I need to go $60,000, $90,000 in debt to learn something on Zoom that I'm not learning to get a job that doesn't require a degree? And I think we started to see that kind of transition happen during COVID.
You also talk about, how some of the things that were supposed to be temporary became permanent, and how the faculty gave up a lot of concessions. This was an excuse to kind of, really rake them under the coals.
Yeah, like faculty, the vaccine issue was one that I spearheaded on my campus. Now that there's, we should make this clarification, like making vaccines available and people getting vaccines, I think are good things. The vaccine mandate by your employer, or it was a really interesting intrusion to people's privacy, that I thought was something that was a bridge too far. Why are we giving this up without some concessions or some protections to ensure that this isn't like a slippery slope?
Right.
And it became a slippery slope. Afterward, we also had to fill out similar questionnaires about whether or not our grad students went on strike, which, we're not obligated to tell. But a lot of this like information started to get mandated on campus, including during like the protests and stuff. They started having bias reporting, which would come out, which we had to like fill out these things to report on campus, or students could report on us about bias. And basically, a lot of these faculty unions just sort of gave this stuff up. They allowed the university to normalize kind of these survey behaviors and intrusion into our privacy. And a lot of faculty members don't have time, because again, they teach on 3 to 4 campuses, to read the union rules to know they don't have to fill these things out. So we're always like rushing to catch up to tell our membership, like, hey, you don't have to fill this stuff out. But it had been so normalized by that point, a lot of folks just thought they had to.
Would kind of a reason for that happening be because you had so many adjuncts and people who were non-tenured, so they're rushing in and out and just happy to have a job? Because one of the some of the things you talk about, like with the bias thing, you can go to Texas and in Florida and people can film you and file a complaint and say, yeah, I think my teacher's hurting my feelings with this lesson, literally. And all of a sudden you have investigations and the whole nine. And so you're wondering, like, wasn't there a faculty union there? Or was it really just an overarching law that just, no pun intended, trump any sort of faculty protections that one would have? In other words, how did this get there? And to me, it seems like it can get there when you have people who aren't permanently enshrined into the community. Like, I'm here for an hour, once or twice a week, and then I'm gone. I'm not really here to deal with the politics of the university. And if tenure track is either weakened or absent themselves, then these things can pass without a whole lot of fanfare.
Yeah, because tenure track jobs used to be about 70% of faculty. Now it's roughly about 35, 36% of faculty. Most are these part-time or non-tenure. And yeah, part of it is they're not on the campus, so you can't get invested in every single fight. The other, the survey I did of these faculty, they said, look, we never talk to full-time colleagues. We almost never talk to our boss. Like we feel so isolated. We're just in our car traveling from campus to campus. But the other part of it is, if you have kids, rent, mortgage, are you going to be confident that you can really fight the university on a vaccine mandate survey during COVID in that climate? Or are you just going to be like, God, I know this is wrong, but like, I can't risk losing this job. It's too important to me. And I think it's that vulnerability that's really key for understanding how Trump was able to steamroll the university, because a lot of people just don't have the power either in their union or a lot of individual kind of faith in the system to protect them. And so many people, even tenure track people, lost their job during the Gaza protests. Some got them back eventually, but just for participating in that protest, they were deemed anti-Semites, lost their job, had to fight in the court to get their jobs back, and they had the best protections faculty have. If you're someone who has no protections, are you going to pick that fight?
Where do you see things now? Say, let's just start with what do you see with the various California systems, the UC system and the Cal State systems.
I think they're in dire straits. The community colleges have revamped the conversation about granting 4-year degrees. To me, that spells kind of more consolidation. I think there's always been a desire since the 1990s in the state to kind of consolidate community colleges and CSUs. It would be a cluster. But I also see a lot of CSUs struggling for money. CSU East Bay, where I used to work, for example, had a billionaire donate money to them, and they're able to keep some programs alive. That's great, but I think it's a bad system to set up where we're waiting on billionaires to save our public universities. I think that speaks to the dire straits. Whole departments are getting eliminated. Management's playing with the idea of replacing departments with AI. I know in the UC system, a lot of the what they call foreign languages or languages or world languages, those departments are getting their jobs are getting replaced with AI teaching. They're trying it, these like large class models with AI. So I think the faculty are really under assault at this time period. And a lot of the university leaders were more than willing to capitulate to Trump because the model had shifted since the 70s to be just about profits. And Trump was holding money over their head and saying, like, look, you want this money, do X, Y, and Z. And X, Y, and Z was get rid of DEI policies, stop making education a professional degree, et cetera. Let's get rid of the sensitive status for the university from ICE and things like that. And they were willing to play ball because they dropped for the almighty dollar. And faculty have had some resistance and some success, but I think a lot of their weaknesses have shown as well and being unable to stop this tide.
When we talk about the universities, we talk about it in terms of the faculty and the managerial class, et cetera. But half the population are students and will be entering college or maybe not. What message do we have for them? What should they be thinking about? Why should they even care about any of this that we're talking about or any of the things that you're talking about in the book? How's this going to impact them and what sort of dance should they be doing with the information you provide?
Well, hopefully it would do with the information provided is resist. I know especially for the last like 20, 30 years, we've used so much messaging about how like online is the way to organize and resist power, but that simply is just not true. You cannot organize a collective resistance online. At best, you can amplify one. That person-to-person communication is hugely important. Your economic future certainly depends on it. That's something we think about often here in a capitalist society. But I would argue your democracy also is depending on this. We're really normalizing a lot of authoritarian measures in this country, and a lot of that's practiced through higher ed. Whether you like higher ed or not, the reality is a lot of the cultural leaders and power figures come from it. And so what higher ed is going to have a huge influence on the culture and country moving forward. This includes things like human rights. Your rights, you really don't realize you need them until they're taken away. So defending those at every level is going to be critically important. And I would hope that students would use the campus space and, pressure or force faculty to march with them and support them as well in a lot of these endeavors.
But I think the average student that's coming up, 17 or 18, they don't have this sense of history that you do, or maybe myself has, to understand why you would want to do this. I mean, there's critical thinking we know has been removed from high schools, right? So it's all about the test. It's all about the test. And the attitude, if I could sum it up, is like, what's in it for me? What do I get out of it? And how can I best, move to create a situation that's going to be beneficial? That's the challenge that I see students having right now. So how do we kind of get them to crack through that, or how do we do a dance with them so that they can start cracking that?
Well, I think communication, making spaces for collaboration is hugely important. And it doesn't have to be overtly political. It could be a bowling league, a gardening club, people who hike together. I mean, any way you can get that human to human connection is part of creating the space. But I think also reminding young people, so much of the rhetoric that they face is about get the job, get the career, get the career. And look, money is really important, and having some sense of financial security is awesome and relieving. But you're going to want more out of life. You're going to want a time with loved ones. You're going to want to be rested. Maybe you want to have children. You're going to want to have experiences. You're going to want to have laughs. That's not going to come in a society where you're working 10, 15 hours a day and you don't have time on the weekends to even, if you have a weekend break, to clean up your house because you're exhausted. So it's not just about the job for the money's sake. It's the type of life you want to live. And right now we're going in a direction where you're wanted to work like 24/7. Your home is being transformed into a place of work. Your car is being transformed into a place of work. I don't think this is the road you want to go down.
Real talk. As we close out, tell everybody, about the book, and if there's any particular chapter or excerpt you really want them to pay attention to. Something that you really sunk your teeth and said, this is the home cooked meal.
Yeah, so the book's MAG Academy, and you can buy a copy at projectcenter.org. And I encourage people to buy from there because some of the revenue goes to that nonprofit, which I've been a part of for a long time. So I think I do end the book with a lot of solutions. There's things I point out too. I think one thing is just reimagining the university, that we've cut so many social services in this country, and we throw everything into the university. And a lot of people at the university aren't in good positions to do things like financial assistance or mental health care, or deal with structural racism. These are things better dealt with folks in other fields. And I think taking that pressure off the university could allow the university to get back to do what it does well, educate students, produce knowledge, be a part of the community, which is another solution I have. Instead of being these like ivory towers that exploit the university around them, they need to be integrated into the community. The community needs a voice in what the university is doing. It doesn't need to tell the community what to do. So I have a lot of solutions like that, include empowering faculty. I believe in free college for all students who want to attend. I think it's an investment in our democracy, not just our economy. But I also think I want to end the college for all mandate. Not everyone should be pressured to go to college. Everyone who wants to go to college should be able to go to college for free, but some people don't, and we should respect the other work as well. Working folks work hard. They should take pride in the work they do, and they should get paid accordingly. And I talk about that in the book as well.
There you have it. Nolan, we appreciate you taking time out this afternoon. We're going to take a break here on Hard Knock Radio. We'll be right back.